Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So it's one pra, Lunar Observance Day. Bit of a smaller community right now, so it's kind of nice, kind of feeling like a family. Those of us who live here in the monastery, and then also the guests who come to visit during the time when we're in the monastery, if we're living here, then we're diving into the practice and we're swimming in our Dhamma practice. Our whole life is our practice. It's a cultivation, cultivating the way, leading to liberation, freedom. Anyone who's been practicing for years will be able to tell you that it takes time, and anyone who's new to the practice and who thinks that they've got it, be careful, watch out. Get ready for something out of left field. The curveballs start coming. One of the things we cultivate in the monastery is a sense of solitude. The Buddha spoke of three different kinds of solitude. There's kaya viveka, citta viveka, and upadhi viveka. And kaya viveka is bodily seclusion, citta viveka, mental seclusion, upadhi viveka is seclusion from the defilements or the seclusion of nibbana. Kaya viveka can be thought of in a couple different ways. We can think of it in one way as getting back to our dwelling place, not being around people, not engaging. That's one way of thinking of bodily seclusion. Another way of thinking of it is the way Lungpur Liem explains it, is that always inhabiting one's body, always seeking seclusion in the body, even when one is around people, even when one is engaged. So I like that way of thinking of kaya viveka as it's like a mindfulness of the body, always inhabiting the body, always being able to come back to the body, the feeling in the body, and always being able to check in with the body. These three kinds of seclusion, they actually go together. Citta viveka is seclusion of mind, a sense of mindfulness, like the mind not going out to things, not proliferating about this and that, or getting lost in some story about ourselves or about some interaction we had with somebody else. And then upadhi viveka, which is the goal of the practice, nibbana, a sense of cooling. So the situation we have here in the monastery that we're practicing is really ideal. We've got a nice balance of communal activities and seclusion. Going back up into the forest in the afternoon, it's or even right now, just listening to the crickets, using nature as a support for practice. One of the things the Buddha said in relating to his own path of practice before he reached enlightenment was that he went to dwell in the forest. And it's quite beautiful the way it's said in the suttas. And he says, my mind found great solace living in the forest, living in a secluded dwelling place at the foot of a tree. And Buddha set the example for us, not neglecting that sense of seclusion. There's another phrase in the suttas, like, alone, alone, one truly delights. And when one is dwelling in seclusion, one's merit shines forth in the 10 directions. And so there's that sense of not engaging, not going out, sense of giving importance to seclusion. So there's a couple different ways we can practice, we can live our holy life, our practice, our spiritual practice. So a couple different ways we can frame it or formulate it. There's what I like to think of as self-centered or self-centric practice, and then there's other-centric practice. So self-centric, of course, is the focuses on oneself. So if we take the five hindrances as an example, sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse, and doubt. So in terms of, self-centric practice, we might sit down to meditate and think, okay, sensual desire is coming up. How do I deal with that? Okay, I got to apply whatever contemplation of the body, or ill will is coming up. Okay, I have to apply this or that practice. Sloth and torpor is coming up. Okay, I'll try to brighten the mind somehow, and so on. So one is the focus is kind of what's happening with me, what do I have to do to fix whatever hindrance, whatever problem is arising. Then there's other-centric practice, which also deals with letting go of the hindrances, but the focus isn't on oneself. It might be that one is just cultivating various forms of goodness. So it's a cultivation of the wholesome. So for example, one might sit down to meditate, and one might be dwelling on thoughts of gratitude for the offerings of the lay people, or the supports for life that we're given here at the monastery so that we can practice. So one might sit down and start to dwell on thoughts of gratitude, just as an example. And it's incredibly wholesome. So there, sensual desire isn't present, ill will isn't present, sloth and torpor isn't present, restlessness, doubt isn't present, the five hindrances aren't present when one is dwelling in thoughts of gratitude. Or, say, during the work period, if various tasks, one has a idea that one is cultivating dana parami, or a cultivation of the perfection of generosity, or the spiritual practice of, generosity as a spiritual practice. And it might be something that's helpful for an individual, or it might be helpful for the community as a whole. One is in that very wholesome mindset of wanting to solve some problem for somebody else or help the community in some way. So right there, the hindrances aren't present. There might be a bit of restlessness, wanting to help someone who's or solve some problem. But for the most part, it's going to be wholesome. And compare that with more of a self-centered way of going about the work period. I got assigned this task. Okay, I'm just going to work for this period of time, and it doesn't matter if I finish it or not. I'm just doing what I'm told. Just tell me what to do. I'm just doing what I'm told. I just work here. And then, okay, 10:30 comes around. Now I can have my meal and then go to my kuti and get my seclusion. And I don't think it should be done this way, but they're just telling me to do it this way, so I'll do it this way. And this isn't really something I want to be doing, but I'm just going to grit my teeth and bear it and do it. There, that's tending towards the unwholesome. One might be going about just dragging one's feet, doing as little as possible. Okay, maybe I'll just look like I'm doing something till the end of the work period, and that'll be enough. Or we might relate to the morning chores or any chores in the monastery that way. Just, okay, I'll just kind of grit my teeth, bear it, do what I'm told, do the bare minimum, and get it over with. So it's hard to think of that as a cultivation of barami. But if we think of dana barami or kanti barami, which is like a cultivation of patient endurance, these are incredibly wholesome qualities. So we're like with kanti barami, patient endurance, it's not like not a sense of trying to get something over with so it's finished, but it's a sense of being able to be present and bear with anything that's happening in our life, no matter what it is. Some difficult situation arises, knowing how to skillfully respond. It's like in the Thai forest tradition, we learn what we call upatthaking. We have like a senior monk, either the abbot or the other senior monks might have an attendant we call upatthak. And this is really a cultivation of selflessness and also cultivation of mindfulness. The tradition is quite strong in Thailand of attending on senior monks, but also it's quite strong here, and it's getting stronger. And it's in the Vinaya, it's in the rules set forth for the monks that we attend to the senior monks, we attend to their needs. And there's basic guidelines of how to do it. Really, if you think of like a good upatthak, it's really interesting, the energy, it's really a practice of not getting distracted. And it's a practice of not focusing too much on oneself. Say one of us, monks or novices, travels somewhere with Lungpa and might go to Berkeley Buddhist Monastery, and say we have his sitting cloth. So the upatthak's job would be to put the sitting cloth out, to know when to put it out, to know how to do it in a way that's not obtrusive, to make sure there's water for the ajahn, to attend to any small needs that might come up. Thinking of Sampajano, who he's since disrobed, but he was a good example of someone who's a great upatthak. Just that sense of, like when he was upatthaking Lungpa in Thailand, that sense of very wholesome sense of helping out with gratitude, not coming from a place of selfishness, but it's other-centered practice, so focusing on another as a cultivation for wholesome qualities. So, or in Thailand, we might take the example of upatthaking a Thai Ajahn or like Lungpor Liam. And the energy that the upatthak has to cultivate is a sense where the mindfulness is at the fore. Like there's these phrases in the suttas, where mindfulness, he sits down cross-legged, establishes mindfulness in front of him. So a bhikkhu goes to the root of a tree, sits down cross-legged, establishes mindfulness at the fore. And I think mindfulness, there's actually a spatial quality to it. So I find it actually does seem to be like in front of the face, or like if you're not getting distracted and mindfulness is well established, then it does actually seem to be in front of one. And so with attending on a senior monk or doing the upatthaking duties, then it really is like that. You really have to be really present and just waiting, ready to act. If the Ajahn is talking with people you don't want to drift off or get distracted, because before you know it, he'll get up and you'll have to get his bag and be ready to attend. But if one kind of drifts off, one is kind of distracted, the Ajahn kind of gets up and leaves. And, hey, where did he go? You kind of open your eyes. Where did he go? And where did you go? So you have to be, always ready to act. If one is distracted, then one is not ready to act. One isn't present. That's a lot of the practice. That's what it's for. It's for that sense of being ready to act. And then one might be very tired. Like thinking of when I was Lungpor Liam's upatthak, we were having to go to these Katina festivals where in Thailand they have the all-night talks during the after the Katina, well, actually before the Katina ceremony. You have all-night Dhamma talks, and then the next day you'll have the Katina ceremony, the offering of robe cloth to the Sangha. And in Thailand, it's a big deal to kind of go to lots of different Katina ceremonies, and one might be up for a few nights, or one might be up all night one night, and then 3 nights later be up all night another night. So you never know, and especially if you're attending on Lungpor Liam and he's being asked to go give talks at all these different Wat Pa Pong branch monasteries during Katina season. If you're his attendant, then that's going to be, it's par for the course. You're going to be really tired. You're going to be gone without sleep. But still, you have to be present and attentive. So even though there might be sloth and torpor, just that sense of focusing on another's needs is incredibly helpful. Whereas if one wasn't attending, the obvious thing to do would be to go and sleep, go take a rest, but there's no choice. That's incredibly helpful for practice. That's one, maybe that's one way to think of choiceless awareness. You have to be aware and you don't have any choice. That's choiceless awareness in the Thai forest tradition. So, yeah, as an upatthak, you have to have choiceless awareness. But it's incredibly helpful. It's other-centric practice. It's rare that good fruits come from like a... Well, good fruits, I think, can come from the self-centered form of practice, because you do have to take stock of your own practice. I think it's good not to confuse a self-centric practice with like with like selfishness. It's not quite the same. So with self-centric practice, you're taking stock of your own hindrances. But the other-centric practice is a skillful means. It's incredibly skillful. I think that's one thing they use that Mahayana Buddhism really has going for it, is like, or Tibetan Buddhism, like Tonglen, the practice of taking and receiving, is the visualization of taking on someone else's difficulties and then giving any happiness and well-being away to that other person or to that group of people. It's just an incredibly skillful way of coming out of oneself. Or it's like Longpa mentioned during his trip to Mississippi, going to this school where they have this writing, like a kind of ethos of their how they run the school, and one point of it saying cultivate so much goodness in yourself that you don't have time to be critical of others. And so that's how I like to think of that as well. And you could take it further, cultivate so much goodness that you don't have time to be critical of yourself also. And to illustrate this, you can kind of maybe take eating the meal as a good example. So as monks, or say living in the monastery, especially coming in as Anagarikas or novices, might feel like, you know, oh, really so much greed around the meal. Like we might be really hard on ourselves, like, oh, I ate way too much yesterday, and just we might have a lot of aversion towards ourselves during the meal. Or on the flip side, might just be like, oh, finally the meal, and never mind, I'm just going to eat as much as I can. Just who cares? I'm just going to give in. And we only eat one meal a day, so I'm just gonna give in, just indulge as much as possible. Or it might be like, okay, I indulged so much yesterday, so I can't eat. I'm going to torture myself today. I'm going to eat only a little bit. So usually it's kind of fluctuating between greed and aversion like that. But then, and that's also very self-centered, so it's like, I'm so greedy, or I need to limit myself, I need to teach myself, I need to train myself, I need to control myself, restrain myself. But then just think of what it's like when you sit down and we do the meal reflection, begin eating, and then thoughts of gratitude come into the mind. And might be thinking about the people in the kitchen who made the meal for us. During our meal, we might be contemplating how much work went into that food, or when we look at the different foods, we might contemplate where each different food came from. So this one dish may have come from that Thai group who came, or this other dish might have come from the Sri Lankan group who came to offer the meal. Or like today, we were on alms round in Ukiah, and then two monks in Redwood Valley and two monks going to Fry Vineyards. So like we might see the different foods and think, oh, they offered that at Safeway. Oh, they offered that at Ruintong. Oh, they offered that at Walter Cafe. And consciously cultivating gratitude for all those individuals who are offering us food. And then the meal's finished, and wow, no thoughts of greed and no thoughts of aversion during the meal, just gratitude. Gratitude isn't greed and it isn't aversion. It's just an incredibly wholesome mental state. And it was also not focusing on myself. It was that wholesome mental state was based on others. And you can take that even further, then there's even more gratitude for others, for even being the object of our gratitude. So it's we can even take it even further than that. All the goodness in our life everything good that we have is from others. Very, very little of it is from just ourselves. Actually, if we think of it in terms of gratitude to parents, then nothing good that we have in our life comes from ourselves. It all comes from our parents. The fact that that we were even born, the fact that our mother carried us in the womb for 9 months and then raised us, and even if we didn't have the best childhood, or even if we had a difficult upbringing, or our parents maybe had problems or didn't bring us up in the best way possible, but still we're here now. We're able to practice, so that's they're still worthy of our gratitude. So for a long time, I kind of didn't understand this point that senior monks would teach about, and Lungpa likes to teach about it a lot, like how we create these stories for ourselves. And I remember years ago I would always think, well, I don't do that, you know. And then, of course, once mindfulness gets stronger, so do I ever do that? We're all in the same boat. I mean, everybody does this. And it's not just like the story of my life, but it's like whenever every interaction, every situation, we tend to build a story around it. And this is a function of delusion. So the Buddha lining out that these are the three basic poisons or obstructions that hinder us from awakening. And that's greed, hatred, and delusion. Or we might think of it as attraction, aversion, and delusion. But delusion is that really insidious one. And I think it goes part and parcel with the way we create stories around all the situations that come up in our life. It's really good to, this is where mindfulness has to be very strong. We have to be very, very careful when we're working with this. So, and it's very rare that people actually understand each other. Even you know, friends, good friends, or husband and wife, couples, you know, it's very rare that people actually understand each other or know what the other is really experiencing or feeling. And there might just be some brief interaction. This is one of the, since I've been a monk for 12 years now, this is one of the difficulties for me of like becoming, like reaching 10 years and becoming a more senior monk, is suddenly people give more weight to what you say. So like you might have an interaction with somebody, or I might forget to say hi to somebody. And that's like, why did he forget to say hi to me? What, does he not like me anymore? So it's like a, yeah, I can, I know I experienced this when I was more junior. Ajahn Jayasuro came and visited Wat Nanachat, and like when I went to pay respects to him, he like didn't speak to me, and then I made this big story around it, like, oh, he's rejecting me, why is that? Why? What did I do? And then like, I remember talking with him about it later, and he's like, no, God, I just was talking to so many people, I just wanted to get back to my kuti. So, or it might be like, you know, what did they mean by that? What did that person mean by that? Maybe they, or what, and let's take some modern, what did they mean by that text? Why did they send me that text? Or why didn't they respond to my email? I think they've, you know, I remember like Tanpa Muto, he's gone to live in another monastery. And about 3 weeks ago, I gave him a long email just checking in and saying how I was doing, and then he never responded. So I thought, okay, he doesn't like me anymore. So there's that story comes up. And then, of course, later I found out he's taken on a practice of not checking email. Yeah. Rarely are the stories, let's say 99% of the time, they're not true. So it's like being mindful of that. And this also leads into maybe the theme of being very forgiving with one another. I think that's one thing we learn here at Abhayagiri, one reason the community is so harmonious on a long-term basis. And I've lived in different communities, and this is pretty rare that that a community is as harmonious as this one. I've seen a few other communities that are as harmonious as this, but it's usually a monk living by himself. So that's pretty harmonious, but it's pretty rare to have a bigger community that's harmonious, and because everybody here, there's that culture of looking out for each other, this culture of being very, very forgiving. Yeah, it's really helpful. It's very helpful for practice. Yeah, there's this also this sense of like being open to whatever comes up. So, like in the course of the practice, as one starts to take on meditation as a lifestyle, meditating for years, even decades, trying to realize the teachings of the Buddha, and as the practice deepens, then it's like calling into question everything. Probably everybody is here has heard the spiritual teaching of, like, if your glass is full, empty it so you can receive the teachings. So this, I quite like that teaching because it really applies very directly to the way we have to practice in a way that's sustainable in the long term. Like Lungpo Cha gave the teaching, like, you're like a spider sitting in the middle of its web, and when a mental state or a situation comes up, you go out and the spider goes out, wraps up its little insect, and goes back to the center. So that's kind of what we have to do with, like, mental states or any situations that arise. We know it. We go out to it. We wrap it up with the three characteristics of impermanent, unsatisfactory, not self, and go back to our center. But I quite like the image of the glass because, as far as practice goes, that's what we're having to do. When we come here, we might have expertise in various areas, or we might think we've got it all figured out, but then we come here into the monastery and we empty the glass out so that we're good vessels for receiving the Dhamma teachings. But then we have to be careful that the glass doesn't fill up again with knowledge, with book knowledge. To be very careful with knowledge, because that limits us. And if we have too much knowledge, we might not be open to the way things are. And so as the glass fills up, we have to empty it again. We have to learn how to keep emptying it. And I think, similar to the spider in the web analogy, we could think of the glass as like every situation that we come into or every mental state that arises. It's like we're putting liquid into a glass and then we're looking at it and we're kind of shaking it around. And then it's like, do I want to drink that? No, I'm just pouring it out. So everything that arises, do I want to drink that? No. Do I want to drink that? No. Do I want to drink that? No. So just tossing it out, tossing it out, tossing it out. The glass stays empty. and the glass stays empty. We don't have to fill it up with anything. And that's how I like to think of the Buddha's teaching of emptiness, is that it stays empty. Anything is possible. Remember sometimes my father will write, he's a writer, so he'll write poetry and send it to me sometimes, and he came up with a really good line: emptiness isn't empty, emptiness is full of freedom. And I quite like that, since that's like the taste of the Buddha's teaching. The Buddha said my teaching has only one taste, the taste of freedom. Just like the ocean has only one taste, the taste of salt, my teaching has only one taste, the taste of freedom. So if it has the taste of excitement and wanting to go into it, no, that's not it, toss that out. If it has the taste of self-aversion, wanting to control oneself, no, that's not it, toss that out. But the cup is empty, okay, that's the taste of freedom right there. There's a lot of good stories of, it's quite lovely actually, a lot of the old Ajahn Mun disciples, most of them weren't really intent upon teaching very much. It was more, Buddhism is a completely different paradigm from what we know in Christianity. We're brought up in a Judeo-Christian culture here. And the paradigm of the Dhamma is so much different. It's a spiritual cultivation in a cultivation of spiritual qualities and a letting go of greed, hatred, and delusion. So it's not really about like missionary work or teaching, and we aren't even allowed to teach unless we're requested, like Anagarika John did the request for the Dhamma talk this evening. So we're not allowed just to go outside of the monastery and spread the good word. Usually people have to come here if they want to listen to Dhamma, or modern technology, go to our website, www.abhayagiri.org. Listen to as many talks as you want, whenever you want. The paradigm of the Dhamma is different, so the Ajahn Mun disciples, they wouldn't be so intent on teaching, and even if you wanted teachings from them, sometimes it'd be quite difficult to get teachings from them. Ajahn Chah, a very senior disciple of Ajahn Mun, known for his keeping of austere practices, living in the forest, very, very quiet monk, lived in the north Thailand most of his life. There's a story of people kind of requesting him to give a Dhamma talk at a monastery. I'm not sure if it was a katina. It may have been some event, but it was a lot of people, and they're wanting him to give a talk. So this is great meditation master, and people are really looking forward to it. And in Thailand, when a monk gives a talk, even a junior monk, they have what's called a tamat, it's a Dhamma seat, which you'll sit higher than everybody else, because even if you're junior, the one speaking the Dhamma is supposed to sit higher than everyone else. And so we don't have that in America yet, because we're very egalitarian. But in Thailand, so he gets up on the Dhamma seat, and then he's not really like absorbed in a state of meditation, but he's just sitting there kind of like quietly Just sitting there. And 5 minutes goes by. He's just kind of like, they've requested the Dhamma talk, and he's not saying anything. And then half an hour goes by, and everyone's just sitting there, and he just says, empty, and he just gets off and goes back. That was his whole talk, a one-word talk. And I think that's really lovely. You can just imagine him looking at his own mind, just like, what's there? You know, there's nothing there. What is this mind? There's nothing there. That's one thing I really love about the teachings of the Buddha. I think, what I mentioned earlier about being careful with knowledge, it's, I think a good example of that is like just the word mind. Like, what is mind? We have to be very careful. Like, we might think of everything we've studied about mind. So we might think we might have a good idea about what mind is or what our mind is. Oh yeah, mind is this, mind is thoughts, mind is mental formations. But then just really think about it. What is mind? Okay, there's the body, there's feeling. We might feel a certain way. We might have a certain mood, but what is mind? Like, what is it? What's its shape? What's its color? Can we pin it down as being a thing? And then the book learning might come in. Oh, but it's thoughts. It's pure. It's inherently pure. What does that mean? So, just really being open, really contemplating, really investigating the way things are. It's good not to, as the practice starts to mature, it's important not to fall back on the book learning too much, or even fall back on Dhamma talks too much. But just to investigate the way things are. So it's just pointing to the way it is, like there's a feeling as we're open to it, or like whatever mental state, there's fear, anxiety, inspiration, happiness. It's not like if we have a mood of fear or anxiety, we don't deny that it's there. We open to it. Or if there's a feeling of happiness, inspiration, or even feelings of peace, deep sense of peace and happiness, not to cling to that and want it to not change. Because that's going to change. It's always going up and down, up and down. It's another lovely story of a senior disciple of Ajahn Mun, but I can't remember who it is. But he's passed away quite some time ago. He was asked to give a talk, and his whole talk, all he said was up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down. And then he just laughed and that was his whole talk. He just said up and down for like 10 minutes. And then he started laughing. And then got off the seat, and that was it. So you have these teachings from these great meditation masters showing us, pointing to what the mind is really doing. I mean, that'd be pretty boring if you had a Dhamma book which just said up, down, up, down, up, down the whole time, but it's that simple. That's what the mind is doing. Or we could say it's up, we cling. Down, averse, up, cling, down, averse. This is like the default tendencies. Neutral, delusion. We've got a good opportunity to practice here. It's good to remind ourselves that gratitude, Gratitude is important. Takes us out of ourselves, out of a self-centered mode of practice. It's incredibly wholesome. Frees us. It's very freeing. So there's gratitude. There's calling into question the stories we tell ourselves. If we have a doubt about an interaction we had with somebody, it's good to talk with them, not to believe the story. Maybe check in. Be harmonious. This is it's in the suttas community. We blend like milk and water. Then it's easy to practice. So there's gratitude, there's questioning the stories we tell ourselves. There's being very open to whatever is arising. These are all important things in our cultivation of the way, our Dhamma practice. This is the Lunar Observance Night, so we'll keep our meditation visual once a week, meditating through the night. And that's a good opportunity to start over, take stock, see maybe where have I lost the plot, where am I going wrong. You can take stock at the meditation practice. Take stock of the stories we've been telling ourselves. Take the glass, empty it out. Good thing to do on the Lunar Observance Night. Whatever happiness and suffering we've experienced in the past week, it's not so important. So it's just coming back to a sense of seclusion, back into the body. Kaya Viveka, bodily seclusion. Being able to take refuge in mindfulness of the body. Not taking refuge in a story or a sense of self, but more taking refuge in things that are freeing, mindfulness of the body, gratitude, taking refuge in the wholesome. So qualities which are really, really important. But anybody who's been practicing for a long time say, yeah, it takes a while for the mind to start to get it, the way these things actually work. It takes a paradigm shift out of our Judeo-Christian upbringing, conditioning, the idea of sin, might feel like a guilt complex. It takes a while to paradigm shift out of that into that sense of cultivation of spiritual qualities. So the this evening, Lunar Observance Night, it's good to take stock, good opportunity. Also, we've taken the 8 precepts, so that's just for a day and a night. In Thailand, normally what they do is the villagers, like at Wat Nanachat, their weekend is the Wan Pra and the day after Wan Pra. So the Lunar Observance Day and the day after Lunar Observance Day, that is their weekend. But of course, we live in America, so people's weekend is always Saturday and Sunday, but the villagers in Thailand go by the Lunar Observance Day, so they tend to go in the morning, take the 8 precepts in the morning, and then they keep the 8 precepts through the day, and then through that night to the next dawn. So we don't do that yet here. People take the 8 precepts here, but it's already evening time, so you're only, if you have taken those precepts and you're not living in the monastery, you're only bound by that till the next dawn. It's not a permanent thing. Okay, so we can get on with the practice. That's enough. Sadhu Karang Dhamma Se Sadhu.